Join me on my hunt as we travel in search of stories through the wind door. This journey has been long anticipated, and we are ready. I'm back.
You missed whole conversations. No. At this point, we were so punchy that we went on a torrent of jokes that I can't even put into the outtakes, because they're all spoilers for books we haven't gotten to yet. I did save that bit, because maybe we can use it for something else in the future, but it is a shame that it had to be excised. Wait, what was I talking about before you...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, we were talking about... Okay. The things you notice about the differences in the way two shamans, in this particular case, Haka and the Silent One, the way they actually choose to portray their relationship to the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Haka uses his connection to the spirits as a blunt instrument, so to speak, and it's how he is apparently the sole leader of significance of Durga tribe. And it's here that I find I need to make a major correction in what we said during the episodes covering chapters 1 through 5, as well as just now, because I was completely incorrect in this assertion. It took a side comment from Alex himself for me to realize that Durga tribe does, in fact, have a chieftain. Two, actually. I feel kind of foolish in retrospect, because the text points this out multiple times, that Gar and Yao are both siblings and co-chieftains, once after the telling of the creation myth in Chapter 1, and again when the tribe is trying to decide what to do with Miguel in Chapter 3. I did remember them as voices in both occasions, but somehow my brain discounted them as merely being cats with opinions, but not the authority to truly challenge or gainsay Haka. In point of fact, Yao and Gar seem to defer to Haka as being the wisest because of his status. So I desire to make that correction clear, even if it doesn't change the truth of what happened, that Haka used his authority to override all other concerns. There was
already the conversation, both now and getting into it a little bit later, that Harao is worried about confronting Haka because she doesn't want to leave her people without a leader, especially considering how it relates to what she's seen in Yamaya Village and everything like that. She doesn't want to have to kill him in order to complete her mission that she has chosen to take on. Never mind that there's a whole bunch of other complex stuff going on there.
It really does emphasize just how uncertain Harao is. She is dedicated to her actions, but in terms of the actually questioning the logic of things, she really does not know if she's doing the right thing, because she values her tribe so much that she was pushing herself excessively at the beginning of the story to get more meat than they could even get through, and it's something that for her to be not only taking and preserving the life of someone who could be a threat to them and to the rest of Brahma, and also be up against the person who not only is a leader, but is a leader with abilities, who has helped turn the tide of significant battles, to take that significant a source of not only inspiration, but raw power away from her tribe would cripple them. And it's just, is all of that really worth at this point? Obviously, we're starting to see the little signs of connection develop between Frau and Miguel. But if you're removing all emotion and being purely just points of logic of for and against, it is a fascinating dilemma, because when it comes down to it, there's not a lot of reasons for Frau to be doing this. I mean, emotionally, yes, there's every reason. So I love that. And I love the continuing internal debate of that, because it really does show that it's not just a simple, I've made my decision and that's that. It's, what am I doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? It is a compelling dialogue, I think, within herself.
Well, we'll talk about more of that in a second, because I accidentally took us off on a different tangent than I intended. The uncertainty as it stands definitely applies to her own reasons for doing things, but there is never a question that, even if she has not always been as demonstrative in terms of doing honor to the spirits, there doesn't seem to be a question about whether she believes in them or not. She definitely seems to, and that is an influence that is a result from the importance of the spirits and the shaman as being a part of Durga tribe. So Haka says that he speaks for the spirits and therefore is able to qualify what is right, what is wrong, what is holy, and what is unholy. We have the experience now with the Silent One, who gives advice and who tells stories and who is able to provide assistance, but she doesn't talk about the spirits a whole lot. In point of fact, the one time that it is brought up, it is in response to Harau's question, where she is looking for some kind of guidance from the Silent One, saying, ah, you want to know what the spirits think about all of this. And she never claims to know what the spirits think. For all we know, she is a shaman that she may believe in the spirits, or she may not. She may suspect that they don't actually exist, but she never claims to actually be a voice for them. She doesn't say, when she learns what she does about Haka hunting them, that this is what the spirits told her. She just said, this is what I learned. And that puts a very different spin on everything, because we are naturally more inclined to trust the Silent One because she is an outsider, because she doesn't have a vested interest in, as we have said multiple times, protecting a tribe from danger, and so therefore she can afford to be a little bit more thoughtful and considerate and, you know, generally interested in finding a way to the truth that doesn't eschew empathy or anything like that. So it makes for a very interesting contrast, and it definitely makes one wonder more about the actual way that the spiritual intersects with the magical.
Something that has been curious to me is her name, because you can read many interpretations, and I'm sure there are many more interpretations that were involved in her naming when Alex first came up with the Silent One as her title. But in one way, if Haka is very much a mouthpiece and is one who is saying the final word on things and is not really allowing anyone else to necessarily give voice to what should be done, then the Silent One is the opposite of that. She is not saying things of her own volition. She's sort of responding to people and responding to Frau and what she brings to her. She's not putting anything back onto Harau except for what she asks of her.
I'm going to try very hard not to use what you just said to speculate on people that we have not met yet as a part of our recap of New Century, but what you're describing sort of depicts the Silent One more as
a facilitator of communication. I mean, in this case, literally a facilitator of communication. But sometimes the communication isn't between two people. It's communication with the self.
So
the metaphor almost is here is that the Silent One is acting more like a therapist rather than a holy person.
Yes, and also everything that she kind of gives to Rao is something that she was already capable of, slash knew for herself already. She says, have you tried talking to him? And she's like, fuck, I'm dumb. Then later when she says, this is what I found out, when she taps into something spiritual, that could be like, okay, she's doing something magical and she's going to impart something that Hrau couldn't know. But she says, you are being hunted. And Hrau says, and I know who by. Essentially, the Silent One is like, so, you think that anyone might be coming after? And then before she's able to finish the sentence, Hrau goes, oh no, it's Haka. So it feels very much like she's just sort of her equivalent of, I need to do this. And the Silent One just says, and I should talk to him, and I should go here, and I think I might be hunted by a Haka. Thank you for all your help. My work
Our
here
time
is done
over now. Yeah. I think before psychology even really became a thing, in a lot of cases, asking someone for help that wasn't necessarily a natural mentor figure, or rather not a parent or specifically a teacher from school, the priest would often be the one that people would go to for wisdom, figuring these things out anyway. So honestly, the comparison isn't actually that unusual. It's just that I guess I forget that a little bit sometimes because I have such a strong negative reaction to the Christian church, like organized religions in general, but the Christian church specifically, because of the more I know about them, the more
learned experience.
Yeah, learned experience. The more I know about them, the more I wonder whether their existence, it doesn't cause more harm than good. And I realize that's a little bit judgmental of me to come down on it hard like that, and I don't really want to get in the way of the good that religion might have done for other people. It's just on a macrocosmic scale. The manifestation of religion isn't really the believers, it's the people in power, and the people in power always use that power in order to subjugate others, you know, whether whether it's the believers or the non-believers. So it's
horses
hard.
Can be shifted by people at any level. Some of the people lower down may be putting it in a really, you know, good direction, but ultimately the person who has their hand on the rudder probably is making the biggest sway, and that can be hard to sort of look at. The words escape me, but yes.
Yeah. It's always kind of hard to put your trust in organizations, especially in 2020. I am more likely to trust a non-denominational mental health care professional because they are just one person whose only vested interest is their patients. One could argue the money is important to their survival, but I also feel like being a therapist tends to lead towards the kind of personalities that are more selfless than selfish. I might trust an individual person that is either a believer or a priest, but that doesn't mean that I trust the religion or the church. And they might, by dint of who they are. Which means that there is an element of doubt or distrust that has nothing to do with them, and everything to do with far too many bad faith actors that belong to that organization. This is also why my trust of the police is at an all-time low.
for similar reasons. Eventually, we will come to a part of the story where we will take a closer look at why Hakka believes what he does. But as it stands now, Hakka still presents himself in such a way that makes me mistrust him simply because he is a shaman. And because the Silent One is framed more like the kind of person I would trust, the fact that she is a shaman does not get my hackles up in the same way.
The discussion of Christianity is not one of the goals of this particular podcast, so let's move on to one of the topics that is the goals of the podcast. And the way the values of belief in the spirits, or at the very least, the values that Harao grew up with as being part of the tribe, or the way she has integrated them into herself, is that, just like some of the other New Century protagonists, Harao doesn't kill lightly. Mm-hmm. One of the topics that comes up is how, as you were saying just a moment ago, how much extra meat Harao was bringing to the tribe, and that there is a concern of overhunting an area that would have negative long-term consequences overall, so therefore, you know, bring it back down to 5, as one might say. Mm-hmm. But even in this circumstance where she and Miguel are in flight, and Hakka is using his ability to use the bodies of beasts in order to track and eventually try and bring down Miguel, which sort of results in, it causes harm to Harao in the process. Once she is able to get over her instinctive reaction, whatever it is that she has to do in order to escape the current danger that is going on, she has a regret for the animals that were killed accidentally during her escape attempts. And she makes a choice, a conscious choice to, since she knows this battle, this conflict isn't over, she has to try and do her best not to do more unintentional harm, because she definitely feels the weight of those deaths. There is a difference between hunting and providing sustenance to the tribe, or killing as a method of preserving one's own life or preserving the life of the tribe. And this experience where she is doing death to animals and feeling bad about it anyway, because that's part of her internal makeup, which is partly informed. She apologizes to the spirits of those animals, and she apologizes to the gods of her world for the actions she has taken, particularly as she is in this place of turmoil where she has chosen a course of action and worries if this is the correct choice of action, both from a, you know, the good of herself, the good of her tribe, and the will of the spirits.
Mm. All this does make Harao's ferocity measured and more interestingly nuanced as a result. It would be so easy to have this big, ferocious tiger warrior be fueled by animalistic rage and who could snap and kill everything around her without a second thought. But she pairs her aggressive impulses with calculation and empathy. She, even in the midst of chaos and the entire jungle coming alive and zeroing in on her, when she is surrounded by probably more information than anyone would be able to deal with, she is still thinking things through. And it makes the outcome of the action sequence not necessarily a foregone conclusion, which is, these animals are attacking me, I must defend myself from them. It's, they're attacking me, how do I respond? What's the best way forward? Because another great scene that demonstrates these two contrasting reactions to action is when, in secret rooms, Annie, Butler, James, and Abigail meet the bandits with Carl and Virgil, and Annie is trying to talk to them and reason away around this, while Abigail is and wants to just react, kill, be done with it. It's the simple, instinctive reaction. And both Harau and Annie's decision to not necessarily take life so freely and without thought is motivated in part by considering the long-term drawbacks that using violence as a short-term solution would have. Harau doesn't want to unbalance the way of life in the eyes of the gods of her culture, because despite her uncertainty towards them, she respects life and what these gods represent enough to know that she won't get far if she goes against it. She has to work within the bounds of what her culture deems the right way to conduct your life within the jungle, as she is, as she attempts to fulfill her mission. And that, to me, is very similar to how Annie is saying that just because half the time it doesn't work when she tries to seek the peaceful option and recruit these people, that doesn't make the half the times when it does work not worthwhile, because they need to recruit more people to their cause. And if they kill everyone, then they're just going to keep diminishing in number until there's no one left. So both of these is this way of seeing things as not just survival. It's more than just survival. And that's what I think always is far more inspiring and motivational to me, is stories that show that it's not just about making it through to the next day. It's about building something that endures longer than that. It's why I'm not necessarily drawn towards post-apocalyptic stories, because so much of the time the focus is on just day-to-day survival. And there's merit to that in terms of the real-world application of sometimes you just have to take things a step at a time and not focus on things being so, the things that you can't control, it's what you can control. But so much of the time, it's never about that. And things like The Walking Dead, it just feels so much more like you're never building to the long term. It's always the short term. And it's great to see in frantic chaos action sequences like this, even here, there is a consideration of consequences that will extend and ripple outwards.
I mean, you bring up The Walking Dead, and the other thing that always happens in stories like that is, what do we give up of our humanity in order to survive? The Last of Us definitely comes to mind in regards to the growing potential brutality of humanity when so many are already dead. Those kinds of stories are generally not very happy-making, particularly when those kinds of stories often be like, well, okay, so I'll draw this line, but I'll go this far, and you just worry that it's complete descent into a kind of gray morality that you can't get behind anymore.
Did you see the Trope Talk episode on Grimdark that released very recently?
I did not see that one, no.
It's very good. But
in that case, yeah, no, I'll put up a link. Well, I'll watch it and then potentially put up a link to it as well. This is OSP you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I've only seen a little bit of their stuff, but I definitely want to take the time to watch more, so well done there. By this point, I have watched it, and it's very good. It puts into context a lot of my issues with certain kinds of storytelling, and also the way that New Century is rebuttal to that. People may remember months ago, I introduced New Century as an entry in the hope punk genre that is a counterbalance to Grimdark. I'm not even going to get into a blow-by-blow here, because that's way too big a subject to get into, especially here. But you can find a link in the show notes to that OSP episode if you haven't already seen it. The interesting thing going on, I just used the word again. The thing that our conversation brings up for me is that just because they're drawing on a common experience, it definitely seems clear that Harau and Haka have
different values. Like, I know that everyone tends to take the beliefs that they belong to, often even religious beliefs, and put their own spin on it. Like, we're not all, people are not all always necessarily doctrinal. Like, this is the only way that this can be interpreted, and that's just the way it is. Obviously, Haka feels that he has the free rein to do whatever it is he wants if it is backed by the spirits. But Haka is not worried about the lives of the animals. Or at the very least, he feels like, he feels that their lives are perfectly well spent because he is getting rid of Miguel, who is a threat to his tribe, and he perhaps believes that the spirits want this thing dead. As I'm editing this, Toby and I are preparing to discuss the final five chapters, which reveal some new things about Haka and this moment. And it's true that in doing this deep dive, I have relearned some things along the way that I had forgotten from back when I originally listened to the audio drama. I understand that the situation is perhaps even more complex than we are making it out to be. But the simple truth is that Toby and I were responding to what was going on as we saw it at the time. And that does not make it invalid. How it looks from our side should be part of the conversation, because all of the context matters.
I had not really appreciated that. This is that really puts into the sharp relief the difference between Hrau and Haka, that Hrau is more respectful of just adhering to the balance of the jungle than Haka is executing right now.
And again, this could be an expression of religious zealotry, but it's clear that his willingness to bend the rules or his willingness to take a creative approach to these values that seem to be ingrained in Hrau herself, they will only bend so far, because her tactic at the end of that episode is to threaten to kill herself. And even though feels like he is justified for trying to kill Miguel, he has not gotten to the point where he is willing to sacrifice Hrau towards that end. And we'll obviously talk more about that next time, because the very next episode, chapter 11, that is at the top of the reading order for our next sequence of five chapters, we'll get into more of the relationship between those two and what Haka actually thinks about everything that's happened so far. But it's clear that whether his own religious values are getting in the way, or whether it's an emotional connection that he has to Hrau, his fervent desire to rid the world of Miguel, he still has limits at this point. He perhaps even believes that Hrau is misguided, or that Miguel is somehow controlling her. That's a topic that even comes up when Hrau meets with the two panther traders. She is worried that they will, if they see Miguel, that they will think that he is somehow mind-controlling her, much the way that Haka is mentally controlling those animals and such like. My point is that the value of life does appear to potentially exist outside of Hrau's values themselves, but it's specifically a part of, like, it doesn't just exist in the world as being a part of the values of Durga tribe. This is a value that Alex is trying to express in all of his fictional works. This is a topic that has come up before, in that if it's a protagonist, then very likely they are going to be someone that doesn't just think that guns are cool and killing is the answer to every potential situation where violence is a hammer to hammer in every nail.
But Haka, we don't necessarily know enough about him yet to be able to see how he sees Hrau. We know how he sees Miguel, and because that has been essentially all he's been fixated with this whole time. So when we see his response to Hrau endangering herself, that does come as a bit of a surprise, because everything has been so chaotic that the splash damage of all of these attacks on Miguel seemed like they could very easily have killed Hrau. So when we see that, when there's no doubt about it, her life really is in danger, the whole thing is called off. That really does challenge what we know about Haka, and shows that there is a lot more left of this character than just this person is going to keep pursuing us. He's not just a, like, he is, his role in the story is the Terminator, in that
it can't be bargained with. It can't be reasoned with. It doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear. And it absolutely will not stop, ever, until you are dead.
But he is, now that's challenged and turned on its head when it's like the Terminator gets to Sarah Connor, and then as soon as, oh my god, I can't remember the name of the male protection lead in the first Terminator.
Kyle Reese,
that's it. And then Kyle Reese points a gun to his own head, and the Terminator goes like, whoa, I didn't realize you were this serious. Okay, we cool off. We'll do this in five. Take five. It's a subversion of the archetype of what Haka has been doing, which shows that he is not just a machine. He is not just a mindless animal on the pursuit. He has more to him. So it's a great moment, because I had forgotten how Hrau gets out of this, and it feels so, his power is so relentless that when you see that, it becomes such a sharp point of weakness, or not necessarily weakness, but she's able to get under his skin at that point, and it's great. It just complicates everything in the best way.
One of the things that were on our list here was very specifically just looking at the chapter-long action sequence that is Chapter 8, and that this is, like, there is going to be future stuff that is going to be similar in certain moments of Steam Heart, as well as one of the major climactic scenes in Uncivil Outlaw, among other things, where the action just stretches out over an entire chapter. And Tiger's Eye is one of the first biggest examples of this. It has frenetic action parts. It has smaller moments where we and they are able to catch our breath a little bit, but it's clear that the sequence itself hasn't reached a resolution. And the audio drama does a really good job of bringing all of that to life, both through the diegetic sound and the music that Alex incorporates into it, but just all of the work that Maureen put into using her voice to almost bring the action to life in our own minds. Like, that tends to be what has to happen whenever you're dealing with anything that isn't a visual medium. And Alex once said that this was the performance of her life, and we believe it with how she just sells ourselves, how she sells the audience on being able to visualize what is going on just from
the way that she says it, the way that she narrates it, the way that she tells us what she is doing when she does it and everything that is going on around her.
Too fucking right.
Yeah.
There will be chapters in later New Century books that capture the same feeling of immediate and immersive flow of action that we see in this chapter. And I think people who are caught up to date will know which chapters I'm talking about when I say Steamheart and Uncivil Outlaw definitely have a lot of the same level of flow that is here. And what you were talking about it comes down to how Maureen sells us on the action. It's because her voice and the way it shifts and changes as the scene develops, her voice is essentially mimicking and embodying, it will shape itself into the feeling of each moment. And that's incredible to me. And I know that that sounds like something that should be, that's the ideal of what voice acting in any performance is, but it just embodies that ideal to me so perfectly that I have to say that there is no doubt that this is a performance of any lifetime, let alone this one, and it's fantastic. But what I was meaning to get onto before taking any and every opportunity I can to praise Maureen's voice acting in this is that the action sequences we see in later books of New Century, you see this is the start of it, that up till now we haven't necessarily seen immersive action. It's all been, at least in terms of chronological release, Let Them Go does have intense and like sitting on the edge of your seat bursts of action, but it's very much small scale. Fewer actions happen, but there's more intensity, if that makes sense. That you know, any movement could be the difference between life and death, and there's not that many movements that happen. It's okay, shit, through a hammer, pin, bludgeon. It's all very, it happens quickly, but every single movement is described with that much more detail, whereas here with Harao, it's happening all at once. The nature of the narration means that you, by the time you describe one beat, the next beat is upon you. And so with this, it's the first time I think that Alex really manages to write this action where you feel like you're in it, that you're not just hearing a description, a report of what happened after the event. And I think he only gets better at relaying these exchanges of blows, these sort of sequence of movements and actions, and have you actually feel like you're there and not just seeing a projection of it.
And it's more than that as well, because, you know, all credits to some of the ways that actors make us feel the action when Loretta is enacting out some of the stuff for Annie Oakley in Arlington in particular, or some of the stuff that's going on for James or Abigail, you know, Alex and Sharon stepping to the plate and making us feel like we're a part of the action. Maureen manages something beyond that, in that she is playing a tiger, a hunter, and a warrior. And man, does she fucking sell that idea just from her speech.
She sounds like this voice is coming from a creature that is far larger than any human could possibly be. And it's just, when I say that this voice embodies everything that Harao as a character is, I really do mean that she makes the character feel physical in a way that I think so many of these other characters are like brought to life wonderfully, but I've gone on record to say that Hrau is my favorite character in New Century, and I still maintain that. There's, I think my answer changes depending on which book I've most recently read, but Hrau is just this character who leaps from the page, leaps out of the audio, and we are carried along with her.
So you say leaps, and all of a sudden, all I'm picturing is, you know, a tiger suddenly jumping out of the pages, and, you know, because Hrau is enormous, she doesn't actually fit in our lap, but then I'm picturing Loretta's voice when she was talking about Captain Beatrix, going, and now I want the brushy brushy. There have been a lot of different choices along the way in terms of how a New Century story is narrated. In Let Them Go, Alex plays the omniscient narrator of the story. In most of the rest of New Century, the narration duties are shared through various mechanisms. The Vox 2, the journal entry, or just one of the characters narrating a moment of the story where they are one of the central protagonists. Hell, when we get to the Princess Thieves, you'll see that Alex switches it up again by having all the characters narrate different bits of the story, some of which they weren't personally there for. But as we've been saying, Tiger's Eye has its own unique feel, in that Hrau does the lion's share, or Tiger's share, of making that world come alive for us. And we will never get that again, due to the fact that Maureen has had throat issues that will prevent her from working on future installments of Rama that center Hrau. That makes Tiger's Eye a gem that stands out, and further affects how much this one story means to us.
All right, well, we still got a bunch of stuff left, so let's move swiftly along from there, because I think we've mined out that particular topic.
Yep. Panthers.
Panthers, yes. not Panther Soul, that's a different panther. Different panthers we're talking about here. Yeah,
we'll get there.
Soon. We know your love for Panther Man. Yes, exactly.
Caresses picture on desk. No, oh, that would be weird.
So our experience. God, we come. Bring your thirst down to 5, there, Toby. All right. Yeah. So our experience with the Panthers, both the traders and the ones at Yamaya Village, that's a study in finally seeing the world from someone that is not a member of Durga. And it makes possible a contrast in terms of some other peoples that are in the world and are not necessarily yet
hostile.
I wasn't going to say hostile, even above and beyond that. They are not necessarily subjects yet. They may be more things that Hrau acts upon, depending on how you choose to view these particular characters, since they are a part of her journey rather than necessarily being on their own journey. Although I guess you could say that by nature, the two traitors are on their own journey as being a function of being traitors. So,
and they gain a certain amount of subjectivity in that they are working with her to try and translate what she's saying. They're trying just as hard to interpret Hrau as Hrau is trying to interpret them. So it becomes less a, okay, work out what these panthers are saying. It's work out what they're saying, but they're also trying to work out you. There is a sort of mutual activity going on here that they are both working hard at, which I think does endear us to them, because it characterizes them in a way that I think is not necessarily big and explicit, but it is nevertheless felt.
Well, that's what you were just talking about a second ago. That's almost a function of their role as traitors. Like, they're not here to start a fight. They have wares. We have wares if you have coin. and so, therefore, communication is a part of the work that they do. They're not here to fight. They are here to sell things. And you can't sell things if you can't
open up a dialogue. So opening up a dialogue with Hrau is important for their own personal goals. And this is where some of those earlier communication lessons become very valuable to Hrau in particular. It's entirely possible that as traders, they would have had to do some of this beforehand themselves. As we just pointed out, they want to be able to make a sale, so they will, you know, use the hand gestures or try to find the common words that they know. Like, they knew some tiger. It just happened to be that Garrick in Yamaya Village was actually able to have a proper dialogue with Hrau in ways that Glam and Mar were not able to.
Yes.
One of the things that I pointed out when I was revisiting this and writing up our notes was the potential different words that cats would use in place of the words that humans would use. The word that comes up again and again in terms of walking or traveling is saunter. And that feels like a very cat word. Like, almost imagine.
It's oddly specific if you were talking about humans.
It would be very specific if we were talking about humans, but that might be the default word for cats in that, because that is how cats move, in that very feline manner. And while the use of it could just be a further way of imitating broken communication, like where they were, Hrau uses terms like doctor food, or when Glam says we have much awesome, like the meaning is communicated, but that's obviously not a proper sentence like you and I would recognize it.
But I love scenes like this because it really does break language down into its most essential components. It's making you think about language differently, where you're going, okay, like, doctor food. It's like, yeah, I guess that would be medicine. Like, that does, like, medicine is a, like, if you don't know the exact word, it's a difficult thing. It's like you're doing a game of charades where you're having to sort of break down concepts and actually think about what they are and how you communicate it when you can't say the word itself. And it's just this exercise in creative thinking that's a very engaging scene to participate in.
Yeah. So that's one way in which we are seeing a different view of the world, is the interaction with the traders. When we get to Yamaya Village, the Yamaya Village is a little bit more complicated because they have clearly suffered catastrophe, because they have lost their chieftain. They apparently have lost their holy person, their shaman. They've also lost the bulk of their strong hunters and everything like that. And so that makes one wonder if the way Garrick is respected in spite of his age and his missing limb, and the way Shal is respected because she is the daughter of the missing chieftain, if that is a function of their society as it normally is, or if they are simply looking to anyone to provide guidance during these times, and these are the agreed upon people that they have chosen to be their mouthpiece, to be the ones that take the lead in making decisions and all the like. It definitely feels like it might be more of a cultural thing rather than an emergency thing, because as Shal is making the decision whether or not to accept the trade of meat for leather from Hrau, everyone is sort of looking to her, like, sort of hopefully, like, please make the decision that will allow us to fill our bellies. And so therefore, when she finally agrees, there is a sort of palpable relief from everybody. Like, they would have been willing to go with whatever she says, but they're glad that she made the decision she did.
Yeah. Women in leadership roles, you get more instances of it in New Century, and it's encouraging to see that in that not only are the women tigers and cats the hunters, they are also respected as leaders. They're not challenged at any point. Like you say, they really are reliant on what her decision is ultimately, and it's like, oh, please say yes, we really want to eat.
Toby's words here just bring to mind that one quote that Sharon used during our Uncivil Outlaw Q&A. 51%, people, she said in exasperation, as to why there still isn't enough female representation in media. New Century has never had this issue. No matter what book we are talking about, there are as many occasions of female characters in the story as male. They are leaders and warriors, doctors and magic users. Some are puissant with their minds, and some are better in physical matters. Some are empathetic, some are hot-headed. Some are villains or anti-heroes. We have mothers and business owners, traders and military officers, adventurers and stateswomen. We have all range of personalities. And you never have to ask if a New Century book passes the Bechdel test. It's self-evident.
One could make the argument that in a feline culture, Alex may have been drawing as much on the way great cats are in nature. Like, I would have to do further study of how that actually works. I have heard that in lion culture in particular, that the female lions are the ones that actually do all of the hunting. That was like...
Yeah, male lions suck. There's the Lion King lied to you. They're awful.
Well, but even the Lion King admits that, you know, it's the female lions that Scar keeps sending out to get more food, and that's why there is suddenly a
lioness's job to do the hunting. Like, Scar is the typical male lion. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're getting off topic. There's no lions in this story.
No lines at all. Yeah, so far we can only work with the information that we are given. So far we have leopards, we have tigers, and we have panthers. Yes, exactly. That is, of course, not taking into account that 6 species of great cat were mentioned as a part of the creation myth in Chapter 1. So lions have come up, but for new readers, you'll just have to wait and see if all of them are eventually represented in this story.
It just feels like one of those moments where we'd cut in with Eddie Izzard. So yeah. So that's what's going on there. It gives us the opportunity to learn more about the world now that we're able to provide some perspectives beyond what we've already gotten. That's a good thing.
And it shows that the interactions between the tribes are not just what we saw in the first chapter. They're not going to just, it's not inherently going to mean a fight will break out. There is trade and amicability between people, enough that one of them number do know tiger. It really does just make the world feel more inhabited. I recently was watching a playthrough of a game where, apart from the main playable characters, there's really no one, and it just makes it all feel empty and just sucks you out of the experience of it, because it feels like an insincere representation of a fictional setting. And having this where there are characters that you will pass by and interact with, it does feel like it's not just Hrau going through an empty jungle with Miguel and Hucker following her. It does just make Rama feel like a living, breathing place, and not just populated by the animals of the jungle. There's also the cats of the jungle.
Yeah, exactly. On top of that, that entire interaction brings back up some of the earlier dread that we were talking about when we were referring to what's it going to be like when armed humans actually make contact with the cats of Rama.
Yes.
When we have
all of these missing hunters from a Yamaya village, we worry that this may already have happened. Like, a bunch of the natives of Rama may already have been killed by humans. And that sets up the fear and the potential conflict in future episodes of what is it that Miguel and Harao are going to find when they finally make it to the waterfall and the wind door. So, yeah.
What could able-bodied hunters be coming up against that they're not prepared for?
You are not prepared. Sorry, have you ever played World of Warcraft?
You know, I haven't. I was a cowl fellow for an afternoon when a friend let me play it, but I have not ever had a chance to do a deep dive. So when I eventually saw that film, I was thoroughly confused.
Yeah, that's... It really only works for people that are fans of the series and fans of the ongoing story throughout, because it mostly incorporates stuff that happened in, I want to say, before World of Warcraft even happened, like Warcraft 1 and Warcraft 2, and it was just strategy game. No, but my roommates are big fans. They played a lot of World of Warcraft, and a number of touchstones were incorporated later into the online card game Hearthstone, and there is this one boss that you come up against called Illidan Stormrage that when you pull out his card, well, when you play any card, there's always a sound effect that comes with it, but there's a line in there that's associated with him, which is, you are not prepared. So even without me ever having played World of Warcraft, I played enough Hearthstone that line just comes up whenever. It's part of my lexicon now. So yeah. This is also a weirdly timely reference, since I just listened to Alex's podcast on Ready Player One, something he recorded back in the tail end of 2019. And in an insert, he reminded us to a time when Activision Blizzard was taking side against the Hong Kong protesters as regards Hearthstone players, which is the reason that to this day I stopped playing that game, or really any Blizzard product.
Well, I'm sure there will be no other occasions in New Century where Warcraft and World of Warcraft influences rear their head.
Yeah, I'm sure you're absolutely right. Oh, look over there. No.
I have one type of joke, which is just sarcasm and dryness, and I just rely on it all the time.
I mean, I don't want to say anything stereotypical about the culture that you come from, but that's very British humor, isn't it?
I don't know what you're talking about.
All right. God, we've been talking for almost 2.5 hours. We have at least one big topic. Bull Rush, let's get right through it, because this is now going to be two very long half episodes. I mean, we're going to edit it down some, but still. Yep. During Chapter 10, we start to see the stress of the experience with Miguel take a serious toll on Harao. Multiple times we've seen her desire to be with others. Like, if she can't be with her tribe, then she has the moment where she's like, I would really like to actually go with the traders and spend some time with them. Or she's invited to stay in the village, and she's like, it would feel good to be with them, because she is severely missing the connection to her own tribe. But she can't do these things because she is worried about the consequences if Miguel is found. And this experience is just so exhausting for her on multiple levels that, you know, where she was able to make connections with him before based on believing him as being a intelligent thinking being that is worthy of respect, at some points during Chapter 10, she literally starts referring to him as a thing, as when she mentions fishing this thing out of the river. Or at one moment, seeing him as being a drain on her and her resources, when she thinks that he wants something more from her before realizing that he doesn't. He is trying to give her something. He is trying to give her a new armlet to replace the one that she had to trade away in order to get more stuff from the traders. And her reaction to that is just so... You sort of get what's going on in her own head, in that she is feeling ashamed, but she is also just so flummoxed as to why this stuff is so important to her. And so far in the chapters, what is actually going on in her head has not been actually revealed. But there is a subtext in the events of the chapter itself that suggests that she is specifically responding to him because he is, you know, as everyone has said over and over again, he is a cub. He is helpless. And that where the two of them are watching, they don't actually give the creatures a name. They refer to them as like elephants, but far larger than those elephants. This is something that Harao has never seen before, but the thing the text shows to us is her seeing the youngest of them following the others and like hanging on to the tail, I think, of the one of the larger of the creatures, much as the way a small elephant would do with their mother in a troop of elephants. And so therefore we can't help but draw significance to that metaphor that's going on there and how it may be affecting Hrau to see.
What's fascinating to see with this journey for her, given what we know about her from the sort of preamble, is that Hrau is a hunter, and not only that, she's a very dedicated hunter. She is doing it so much that it is clearly what gives her purpose. She puts all of who she is into continuously providing meat and hunting. And as we touched on earlier, she's not sort of like wantingly like killing. She's not doing it for the sake of killing. It's just more that this is something she knows how to do and how to be useful is to do this. And she is finding herself in a position where she is doing kind of the opposite of preserving life. The hunting is very much about going out and seeking, tracking down and ending something unfamiliar for the preservation of those around you. And she is taking something that she, when she first saw it, thought doesn't really have enough meat on him, and it's something unfamiliar, and she's preserving its life, and it's unfamiliar territory for her, and it's something that is, in order to protect this creature, she has had to abandon the thing that gave her purpose, which was protecting her tribe and preserving her tribe by doing what she knew how to do. She will show Miguel how to hunt, but he is not necessarily, we have seen from his training that he doesn't have the ability or the experience to necessarily do that, and or at least do it as efficiently, as effectively as Hrau is. And the obstacles and roadblocks she comes into, it's all just so much frustration that she doesn't know to direct herself, because her purpose has been kind of halted. And it's that feeling that I can't help but see all of this and think of it as a narrative that's analogous to becoming a new parent to a baby that you don't know yet. You don't have that developed connection. You, through instinct, you are protecting and preserving their life, but you don't know them. They are a creature, and on the rougher days, you do look at that child, that infant, and think, what more do you want from me? And although you see exactly, you know exactly what they need and what they are, there are times where you can't help but feel all that you are having to give up and all that you are giving to this new life. It's tough and hard, and it's a tough and hard part of the book to go through, because you know that Miguel is a good kid, or at least you feel that so far. You know that there is the potential for Raoul to make further connection, to grow and develop this, but you are also confronted with everything that this journey is putting Raoul through. And she wants to be angry and upset towards Miguel, but his gesture complicates that, and that in a way that makes it even worse that he is doing that. If he was easy to hate, then she would probably go, sod this, like, what am I even doing it for? But it's that she is at her moment of most uncertainty, and then he does that. And I'm just going around in circles and talking about how the conflict works in this story, but Fire Lion, dang it, it really does work.
Yeah, and this actually dovetails really well into the last thought I had in regards to these chapters, was that Tiger's Eye is a story about subtlety, and there's a lot of subtle details in here, which some of them will be paid off in what we actually learn in future chapters, and some of this you just sort of have to take with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Yeah. Well,
grain of salt is perhaps the wrong word. You sort of understand and are able to associate values with it or see the metaphor at play, even if it's never actually made explicit.
You take things by faith.
Well, you just that whole monologue that you had there a moment ago about this experience being comparable to raising an infant that can't understand you in the same way that Rao and Miguel can't understand each other at first. There are obviously more at play there when you are raising something young, because you are starting from a place of non-sentience, so to speak, and are only able to have a relationship more of equals as you are able to interact with them as a subject rather than as an object, to use the narrative language here. But on top of all of that, it's because of the nature of the way the story is being told and the way that Crow keeps things from us by keeping things from herself, the unsaid things or the inferences taken from the subtle responses to what Rao experiences, those all become important keystones of unlocking the story as it goes. And it's definitely what encourages us along the way. And here I have to put in an insert because I didn't properly transition during the Skype call. In order to explain what I'm talking about, I'm going to refer to a favorite piece of media, the HBO TV show Deadwood, which on the surface of it, you would think it would actually have nothing to do with Tiger's Eye being a completely different genre. But part of the reason why I found that series as compelling as I did was that there are things that you can watch and get the most out of what is happening just from listening to people talk. And so therefore you can be like on your phone or paying attention to something else. And as long as you're devoting some of your mental capacity towards what people are saying, then you can pretty much get the gist of whatever's going on there. It means that you're missing context, but sometimes for those of us who have spent a lifetime communicating online and so therefore have been without body language or other visual signifiers to work with in having a dialogue, we're sort of used to that to a certain extent. Deadwood stood out because I actually had to pay attention to the body language in order to get the full oeuvre of what was going on. Because you actually had to see the expressions on people's face, the gestures they made. There was a quality of the language that sometimes meant that the way people chose to say things, you had to unpack it a little bit, or you had to understand what mimetic signifiers they were using that we might not be familiar with. And so therefore it required a lot more attention. It required the full attention, and Tiger's Eye is somehow able to capture that even with no visual signifiers at all.
The feeling, I mean, the feeling that the words by themselves are not enough.
Well, putting it that way sort of plays in a little bit to one of Alex's own peccadilloes, is worrying that his words are not enough to carry the story. And I definitely don't want to. None of us want to encourage that idea. But
by, as a clarifier to that statement, I think it, I meant that within Deadwood and in Tiger's Eye, it's the sort of spoken words, which are the idea that there is, like, everything comes together. It's the, like, narration and the meaning and the way these words are framed that, for as easy to wrap your head around as the events of Tiger's Eye are as a story, it is so sensory in how it is communicated to the reader and the listener that you can't help but lose yourself in it. That's what I mean by it, is that the dialogue is strong in and of itself, but it's how the rest of the connective tissue that the rest of the language is using accentuates it and makes it excel. It's why coming back for a second, third, and even more passes feels rewarding, because going back to a memory of an event and going over the emotions and feelings you were experiencing at the time can be such a valuable and therapeutic experience. And that's what going back to Tiger's Eye feels like to me. It's me going to a stretch of time that had an emotional impact on me and re-experiencing and re-evaluating all of the myriad emotions that I went through during that time.
There's actually a moment within these chapters that is strongly emblematic of what we were talking about, which is there is a moment during the hunting narrative where Hurao is teaching Miguel how to hunt under the pretext that he needs to be able to figure out how to take care of himself in case the two of them get separated. That's her explanation as to why she's doing this. And when the hunt itself goes south, she uses the words that she had previously in order to speak to the spirit of the dead animal, as much as she did every single time that she killed another animal during the hunt or killed the leopard. But the difference between the text of the story and the way Maureen acts it out are miles apart, because you can hear in her voice acting of it that she is like the equivalent of gritting her teeth and being so goddamn frustrated that things happened the way they did. It is a level of complexity and context that just adds so much to the experience. And
thank you, Ibex. You obstinate little bastard. You fought too hard. Rest now. Go with the Father of Passing and return to this world in whatever form is next.
I definitely expect that there was direction that came from Alex to get there, but that adds itself to what makes Tiger's Eye such an experience to listen to.
It's electric.
Woogie, woogie, woogie.
What a way to deflate.
All right. I think I'm, yeah.
All right. The
punchiness is starting to get to us, and we have gone on a long time.
We began in the punch, and we end in the punch.
Yeah. It has been 84 years. Well, next time, we're going to get into chapters 11 through 15, and we are going to experience what happens when the narrative viewpoint shifts.
Yeah,
and that's all we're going to say about that for now. We hope that you've enjoyed our dive into Tiger's Eye, and we'll see you next time on another trip through the Wind Door.
Take care.
It's not easy to talk about the story in bits and pieces like this. Not when we have already experienced the whole thing and therefore have to hold knowledge back, as opposed to people that get to say, review episodes of a TV show as they come out, and they know no more than any other viewer. Or the way Alex and Sharon can talk about an entire movie with the expectation that everyone has already seen it. I think we do a pretty good job overall, but with Tiger's Eye in particular, it feels like there were so many small details that I missed along the way that this deep dive is practically necessary in order to fully appreciate what this story means. The deeper we get into the story, the more there is to discuss. Maybe it would have been easier had I chosen smaller sections of the story to cover during each Skype session, but the simple truth is that both as I put together the topic list, and then as we discuss these topics and our narrative expands, we end up needing more and more actual discussion time to cover everything. And that's good, but holy cow, it takes up a lot of brain space. And it also means that it's very possible that our final episode is likely to be very heavy once we can discuss the entire story in context. For now, we are done, however, and can leave you with a little music to relax to. Once more, we're going back to Afrokilt Sound System, but it's one of the pieces that has English lyrics to go with it. I encourage you to pay attention to them, because in many ways, it's the lyrics that made me decide to use this piece. It's almost as if the song is about the experience of listening to Tiger's Eye, of becoming a part of that world through Hrau's narration. She is on a journey, and we are on it with her. Until next time, this is Persistence of Memory. For full context with this outtake, there was a piece of our pre-podcast recording that didn't come out well, where I talked about us clicking the record button at the same time was like turning two keys together, like they do to activate GoldenEye or get the Terminator chip out of the Cyberdyne vault. And I was then going on to talk about a moment from the other night where I was keeping odd coronavirus hours again.
The thing that happened as I was getting my ice cream and I was putting on Enola Holmes, because that was the new thing, the new hotness.
The new hotness.
Using exactly the same words there. Just
speaking
eat my
of turning the keys at the same time.
Yeah, just eat my sandwich there, dude. Eating the sandwich in my mouth as I'm eating it too. It's like you just push your face over, and so we're both
sounds oddly intimately Lady and the Tramp there.
yeah, but it was.
Oh, that's going into a like the after credit segment somewhere.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, I've been doing that more and more recently, is instead of just doing the bloopers where I fuck up recording or during the edit or when one of us speak during the actual recording, I've been taking things from like pre or post whatever if it's particularly amusing or interesting.
Well, fortunately, you are a very amusing person to be around, and I am a source of very dry humor.
No.
I don't know what I'm even fucking talking about. Boy.
You're quicker on the uptake sometimes than I am, so. Just in terms of like being able to pull something out of your ass, it just.
I'm an arts and humanities scholar. I pull everything out of my ass.
If there's one thing that I've noticed more and more as we've gone over the, like, I don't necessarily notice as much when it's actually happened because I'm being present there, but as I've gone back to edit previous episodes of us talking, whether it's just you or me, or more recently, it's like with you and me and with somebody else present, you feel far more comfortable taking the lead and bringing it right around to whatever it is that you're thinking, or knowing the exact right moment to start lead us into the next topic of discussion. Because I'd always been taking the lead with that, but you got better at it along the way.
That's good to hear, because I think that's probably is quite connected to that difficulty that I had been having, was not just sort of reacting, but anticipating is, I think, the best term I can, the best way I can articulate that. But that's really encouraging to hear, actually. That does far more good than you may realize. Thank you.
No problem at all. But there's less likelihood overall for us to speak over each other.
I completely agree with that. Sorry, please go ahead.
At one point during this recording, I kept getting distracted by Discord notification beeps that were causing me to lose my train of thought, but also made me worry that the beeps might be making it onto the recording itself. So while I tried to resolve the issue, you get to listen to this little gem of an outtake.
Do you hear the beeps now, Greg?
The beeps are telling me. They're telling me secrets. Okay, I think I've turned them off for the moment.
Either that or you're censoring yourself and me.
God damn it. That's a reference to something, isn't it? I've forgotten what it is.
I was not deliberately doing anything other than the general practice of, beeping when you want to. Also, IT Crowd has a good moment where someone is on hand, and that's good. Anyway, back to the main thing. Have you made any progress with Discord?
Hold on a second. Noise reduction. I'll just turn the output volume down to zero.
So, we are experiencing technical difficulties. We'll be right back.
After these messages, we'll be right back. As we got into last episode, the quagga is an animal.
And in this case, it's the game that people are playing is called Vampyr, but they don't refer to vampires as Vampyr or vampires in that world. They call them Ekans. And the thing
the,
that people the might
Pokemon?
Be... no, not... That's... wait, is it?
Ekans.
Oh, wait, you're right. Ekans is right. Snake backward. Okay, maybe I'm remembering that wrong. Then it's okay. I'll get the actual, clip, and then I'll remember exactly what it is. Oh God, Pokemon are so weird. For further context with this clip, there is a Pokemon called Ekans, which looks like a snake, and is essentially just the word snake spelled backwards. I know about Ekans thanks to Jim Sterling. In the Don't Nod video game Vampyr, on the other hand, Ekans is spelled E-K-O-N-S, which means that the Supreme Leader of the First Order is actually a vampire? Okay, that makes as much sense as anything.
Wait a minute, does that make Dracula an Arbok?
I don't know, I don't know as much about Pokemon as other people do, so...
We have to drink the blood of humans, and if you use a thunderstone on me, I will evolve.
Okay, this is going to be a great outtake for this episode. Glam, that was the name of the other panther. I'm sorry, I was blanking on that because I was thinking of Flam, the name of that fake business that the... that was played by Toni Collette in Knives Out. And I was like, no, that's not right. And obviously, this one bit was recorded before I knew I was going to use the Miracle of Sound song as the coda to an earlier episode, which means it doesn't fit here anymore.
Khajiit.
Yeah. Because she'd like to sneak and tinkle stumble and sneak, sorry. Yeah.
Well, I know what the ending song for this episode is.
Yeah, no, I think we just put that in stone there.
I hope that you will come to do business with us again.